Starting Overdrive. Real stories of starting over with Red Seaton.
Hey everyone, welcome to Starting Overdrive, where you'll hear real stories of starting over from real people from all walks of life. I'm your host, Reg Seaton. As society rapidly evolves and we keep pace with change, so many of us find ourselves having to start over in life. Sometimes we start over by choice, to get a fresh start, to find our purpose, or follow our dreams. But oftentimes, many of us are forced to start over when change suddenly and unexpectedly disrupts our lives. For some of us, the seeds of change were planted years ago in specific childhood experiences that alter our lives as adults. In many ways, change can haunt us all throughout life until we confront it head-on in order to start over and be free. Some of us are more prepared than others to deal with change, whereas many of us struggle to start life anew. Change can be the most freeing experience in life, but change can also be the most painful experience that leaves us lost and struggling to start over. Today's guest is Mike Brown, creator, founder, researcher, and co-host of the popular true crime and dark history podcast, Dark Poutine, which you can find at www.darkpoutine.com. Mike's story of starting over begins in this episode with the life-changing decision to leave the security of a 9-to-5 job in order to follow his passion into podcasting. It was a tough decision to start over and take such a huge risk into the unknown, especially being a person who was afraid of risk and uncertainty. But for Mike, that risk became an even bigger reward when after a year, Dark Poutine was voted one of the 10 best podcasts on Apple. But Mike's story of starting over goes much deeper into relatable life moments so many of us struggle with on a daily basis. Not only did Mike Brown leave everything he knew behind in his hometown of Bridgewater, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada, to start over all the way across the country in Vancouver, Mike also had to confront starting life over as an adopted child, while also starting over years later after taking action to confront a traumatic, painful encounter in his childhood that haunted his life as an adult. Find out how Mike started over from it all. Join me now as I talk to true crime storyteller and co-host of Dark Poutine, Mike Brown, on Starting Overdrive. Mike Brown, welcome to Starting Overdrive.
Thank you. I've started over many times.
Before we get too deep, I want to let everyone know that you are the creator.
Yep.
Researcher and co-host of the wildly popular weekly Canadian true crime and dark history podcast, Dark Poutine.
That's right. Dark Poutine.
Have you actually gotten used to people saying that?
I am not used to that yet. It's kind of weird, actually. I had an idea to start this podcast to do something, and I bought all the equipment and it just sat there looking at me, haunting me. I even had the name for it initially as well, but it was just, I was doing nothing with it. I wasn't writing. I wasn't researching. I hadn't done a single thing. I was terrified to do it. But it wasn't until I asked my buddy Scott to join me so I could tell him a story each week that things just all of a sudden took off.
You were recently named one of the 10 best podcasts on Apple. How does that feel?
That feels unreal. Just the fact that this little podcast that I do from my own home, I put all the work into it, researching, writing, doing all the editing all myself. Scott comes over, like I say, I tell him a scary story. Then I layer in the music, release once a week. The fact that this little thing that I do is one of the 10 best so far on according to Apple is amazing. It was unbelievable when I got the email from Apple to let me know.
It really is amazing. To me, it just seems like you launched just a few months ago.
Scott and I chose October 31st as our launch date because October 31st was important to me. Number one, it's Halloween and one of my favorite days of the year. But also, I was adopted on Halloween many moons ago when I was like 4 months old. So it's kind of like my second birthday.
So you have that moment as well from a starting over standpoint.
I have lots of stories there too, because now I know who my birth family is.
Well, that's what I want to get into as we get going. But for those who may not be familiar with Dark Poutine, can you elaborate on what the show is and why you're so passionate about the cases and stories you cover?
The big part of it is I want to cover cases that Canadians may be forgetting about. You know, we'll cover the ones that everybody's heard of, like Clifford Olson, we've done that. But there are other cases, smaller cases, that are still, I feel, just as important for Canadians to know about, to maybe learn about ourselves. Cases that you would hear about in that happened in Saskatchewan, but you're not going to hear about it in Toronto or Halifax or Vancouver. But they're so, the stories are so compelling, I feel like everybody wants to hear them. And clearly, I was right, because we have 120,000 listeners a week.
Is there one story that stands out that made you guys step back and say, okay, this is why we created the show?
There's a few, really, because we've done the Halifax explosion is one that we did, and I'm sure you're familiar with that, having lived in Halifax. But there were a lot of other Canadians who we chatted with afterward who had no idea that that had happened at that time. And another one that I feel that we really captured Canadian input or a Canadian telling of a certain story is the Elisa Lam story. She is the young girl who went missing for a time. She was staying in a hotel, the Cecil Hotel in Hollywood, and went missing in it. And she had drowned in the water tanks on the roof of the hotel there. And she was here from here in Vancouver. So this is why we covered it. We tend to cover only cases that have happened to a Canadian or within Canada. And a lot of what I had seen podcasts cover of her were people who sensationalized like a supernatural, unexplained aspect to what had happened with her. And we brought it home. We feel like we really brought it home and humanized her as somebody who was having a psychotic episode, or should I say a psychic break with reality due to her not taking her meds as she'd been prescribed. So this person was in crisis. And the only reason that what happened to her is because honestly, she was alone and she didn't have anybody to care for her at the time. So I think it even made it a little more tragic. But I really feel as Canadians, it's important for us to stick with what's real and be compassionate to the victim and the families and the communities of those victims or where the crimes happened. Because a lot of this is like, let's talk about the killer. Let's talk about, you know, let's sensationalize the crime, but that is entirely not what we are.
How has your approach to storytelling changed since that very first episode? I know the first episode that you guys did, The Floating Feet, here in BC. How has your approach to storytelling changed and evolved or matured over the course of the episodes?
Well, I listened to that story about The Floating Feet, and frankly, I'm a little embarrassed. I think we were a little too light about the people who had belonged to the feet. But I would treat that a little differently now. We really emphasize compassion and understanding and empathy on our show. So I don't think we were as empathetic as we could be on that show. So people maybe listening for the first time will hear us maybe a little more harsh than if they were to listen today.
How has your life changed, Mike, in such a short amount of time with the show's popularity?
I work full time at it now. I'm not employed anywhere else other than for this show. That's a big change for sure. And being recognized is really weird too. I find that is the strangest thing when somebody especially recognizes me for my voice. It's very creepy. I was standing in line last year at a conference in Nashville that I was attending, and a woman came up to me and said, you're Mike from Dark Poutine. And I was like, how do you know? Have you seen my picture somewhere? And she said, no, I recognized you by your voice. I heard you talking to your friend here.
Were you prepared for that?
Not at all. I've had to actually reach out to some people who have, I don't want to say I'm a celebrity, but they are. And they understand how to deal with this kind of thing, because I'm new to it. I'm new to having this many people listening to my voice week after week. So I've reached out to a number of authors and people who have other successful shows and do successful things on TV and in movies. And they've been really helping me to navigate my own ego, really.
To stay grounded.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned leaving your day job, and that's really where I want to start your story, because you and I actually had a conversation about 3 years ago at a mutual friend's place when Dark Poutine was just an idea and you were working for a telecom.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that people will really relate to. Do you remember that conversation?
I remember bits of it, but I'd kind of like to hear what your recollection of it is.
You were really conflicted and caught between following your passion to create your career and keeping your 9-to-5 job and not taking such a big risk. That's what I remember about the conversation. And it's really wonderful to see where you are now. But at that time, you were really conflicted. Looking back now, I'm wondering, what did that conflict feel like?
It was really difficult. I've always wanted to do something in entertainment in some form. I've been trying to shoehorn my way in to the entertainment business somehow. And the more I forced it, the harder it seemed to run away from me. It just seemed like, oh, there's no way I'm not going to be able to make it, because I would end up, say, for example, I took this job at this telecom and I'm succeeding there. So I can't apply the amount of time that I would like to do what I want to do, because that job is very demanding. But at the same time, I had a lot of security there. I was making quite a bit of money, and enough money that if we wanted to, my wife wouldn't have had to work, even though she did choose to work. But I had this decision to make at the time I was talking to you, and it was security or passion, security or passion. And I struggled with it for a long time. But it wasn't until I actually started recording the show that I really realized this is truly what I want to do.
What were some of the fears that you had to face in that process of the transition from doing the episodes to feeling that passion to that clear defining moment of starting over?
Well, I think what it was just realizing that the passion was real and that I couldn't ignore it anymore. Like, I felt compelled to do it. I was compelled to do these things. I cannot stop doing this show every week, not because somebody is paying me to do it. That's not what's driving me. It's still this passion that's driving me. So this is why I think I had that defining moment when the telecom offered me a deal to either stay with them and grow with the company or take a big bag of money and go away. And it was just, holy crap. I now have the opportunity to take a risk that I've been terrified of doing with a bit of a buffer, a bit of a, let's just say I had a pillow to sit on while I was falling.
In that, how important was your wife's support?
She is amazing. She's an amazing person, and she's supported me through some really tough things. I mean, I wanted to be an actor at one point, and I went to film school, and we went into some serious debt for that. She watched me go away and work night after night after night on horror movies that, you know, we were getting paid a little bit, but I was really going nowhere in that business. I think this other thing she saw as different because she saw how it lit me up inside. I don't feel I got a moment's doubt from her.
That's great to hear, because I don't think people really understand how difficult it can be to leave that to create your own work structure at a home studio and to create that 9-to-5 structure for yourself, whatever that is. But how did you work through that to create your own structure to make it work?
Well, I've never been really a disciplined person. I'm just not. I never have been. It was weird. Once I started doing this, something inside of me just kind of snapped, and it was like, oh, okay, this is what you need to do. This is just definitely what you need to do. It's like you step on the right path and the wind kind of carries you. I've had people ask me, oh, tell me how you succeeded. It's almost impossible to even quantify. What I do believe is that I have kind of found my purpose, and it's not for lack of trying. That's how it feels. And doing the next right thing, getting up in the morning to do my writing, feels like the right thing to do. So that's what I do.
When we talked 3 years ago, dark poutine wasn't a reality. Your purpose wasn't a reality. You weren't feeling that right thing to do. The show was still in the unknown. What did you learn about your relationship to fearing the unknown in order to actually launch the show?
What I realized that the fear was entirely between my own ears. There was no reality to it at all. And the reason that I was so driven to do the show and the reason I was so conflicted on the night that you and I spoke is because I knew deep down that's what I was supposed to be doing. I knew that this was a good idea and that I was going to be able to execute on it, and that there was going to be a lot of learning, which there has been, and some tough moments, which there has been. But all in all, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I think that's where the struggle was. It's like, I was fighting against this idea that had bubbled up inside me that was the right idea, but my fear is what kept me from actually taking action on it. My mic here sat alone for almost a year with no activity at all. And every time I go to the bathroom, I have to walk past this room and I would see all my gear just sitting here gathering dust and think to myself, oh, another thing I failed at. But it wasn't. It was something that I was choosing to fail at it by not beginning.
Well, how is that fear different than, say, moving across the country into the unknown? Are there any similarities?
Sure. But my motives for moving across the country were running away. So I had a not so spiritual motive of, I just want to run away from my life. So my dad agreed that I should run away from my life and gave me a one-way plane ticket and $500, and off I went.
So the difference is running to something versus running away from something.
That is correct.
Well, how long did it take you to feel empowered by your decision to start a new career in a medium where you actually have to create your career path from scratch?
I've felt like I still suffer sometimes from imposter syndrome, where I feel like, oh man, I shouldn't be doing this. Somebody else should be doing this. Don't they know I don't know anything? And all those kind of things. I have moments of it every single day, but those are fewer and further between than they used to be. And those are just noise. It's just noise in my head. It's not real. It's something that I thought. I am one who has spent a lot of time believing that my thoughts are reality. So taking my own advice is probably not the best thing to do.
Well, since the show's become successful, you've actually realized your purpose and you're feeling and living that right thing to do. In what ways has your aversion to risk evolved over the past couple of years?
That is one thing. I mean, I'll go all the way back. When I was a little kid, I was terrified. I was the last person to learn to swim. I was the last person to learn to ride a bicycle. I didn't want to steer my dad's boat for fear I would do it wrong. And it wasn't anything that they were doing outside of me, like judging me or anything like that. But I was a very, very fearful child. It was not okay for me to do anything outside of my comfort zone. So for me to do this kind of thing and really go out on my own shows that I have a little bit of faith in something, that I maybe have some faith finally in myself after years and years and years.
Well, looking back on that conversation to where you are now, was the transition to Dark Poutine and the podcasting world as difficult as you once thought?
No, not at all. All I started to do was I reached out to other podcasters. I reached out to people who were involved in doing radio and sound for a living. And it was amazing how many people wanted to help. I kept, like, in my Evernote notes, a whole Facebook thread that a friend of mine here in Vancouver who works in video production actually connected me with people like Buzz Bishop, the radio guy, and other successful podcasters and audio folks. And they all gave me such great information that it helped me to figure out where I needed to start and what I needed to do. And it was all I had to do was ask for help. That's all I had to do. So I try to pay that forward. If somebody wants some help, I will totally have a conversation with you about what I think you should do. And sometimes I'll be brutally honest with you. So oftentimes people don't like to hear what I have to say, which is just friggin' do it and get over yourself.
That's good advice. I sat for 6 months looking at this podcast equipment myself. So,
and I think I've said that to you as well.
Absolutely. But I knew from earlier that you said that you sat for a year and you looked at your equipment. I remember that. And I remember, oh, I'm not alone. I know that I'm not alone in this because Mike went through it.
Yeah.
And that made me feel good because I knew that I just had to sit and allow myself to align to taking that action. And there's no timeline for that, really.
No. And that's why I share these things. I share my failing as much as my success because I think my failing ends up leading me to my success anyway. So if I don't share, hey, Reg, I've been in the same place that you are, you're not going to be able to relate to my success at all. It's like we have to have a starting point, a common ground to have a conversation about what it means to get going on something creative. And sometimes that is that writer's block or whatever you want to call it that holds us back from actually doing what we want to do. And I 100% believe that it is all between my ears. All those doubts, I can externalize them all I like with the economy or popularity of a certain genre. All that stuff is 100% bullshit. It is 100% me making excuses why I should not do something.
Well, I think a lot of people can relate to that process of creating those stories in your head. And you and I connect with each other on personal levels. We've talked over the years. But on a deeper level, though, we both have personal experiences with trauma in different ways. I'm really interested in how does your own connection to traumatic experiences manifest and show up in your approach to telling real stories about real people?
I did in episode 10 of my show, I told my story. One traumatic event from my story is when I was 11 years old, I was walking home from playing floor hockey with a bunch of buddies, and it was the evening. I saw somebody first coming down the street, and then I felt that person following me. And one thing leads to another, and that person ends up grabbing me, dragging me into the woods, and telling me that he's going to do absolute disgusting things to me that no adult should ever tell a child. I end up getting away, but that event really stuck with me for years. It made me question my own sexuality. It made me question, am I going to be one of those people who do those things to people? All that kind of thing. Like, just that one particular event has brought me so much struggle in my life. I mean, there are other things, but that one particular thing has caused me a lot of grief. But it wasn't until I was able to share that story with somebody else who had possibly seen that side of human darkness that I was able to give them some relief and let them know it was okay to bring their story out into the open. I think that's why I tell these really dark tales, is because the human shadow, if we don't look at it, if we can't somehow interact with our own darkness, be it through true crime or horror movies or what have you, I don't think we can enjoy our lighter moments as much. You know, if you haven't seen the darkness, how do you know when it's light?
That's where you and I connect on. To be honest with you, I've actually had a similar experience growing up in Nova Scotia as you did, and I got away, but it didn't really define, it didn't haunt me like that. And what I'm curious about is, as an adult, how do you start over from that child that's still inside yourself to reconcile that experience?
Well, that particular experience, there was more to it. I later learned who he was and would see him around town, but I was too afraid. I had this something inside me again that wouldn't allow me to go and have a conversation with the police about who this guy was. So he was never identified when I was living back there. And that part of it haunted me too. Like, my inaction haunted me as well. But looking back, I was terrified of what was going to happen and what would happen if I had to confront this man. I just wasn't ready to do it. So it wasn't until in my early 40s, I believe, or even my late 30s, that I actually walked into the RCMP station in Burnaby, British Columbia, and spilled my guts to them about what had happened. And they took it seriously. I heard from the Bridgewater police and had to do a photo lineup of the guy. They gave me a picture of him that was like 30 years older than he was, so I couldn't identify him. Had they given me a picture of the guy, what he looked like then, I probably would have been able to. But that's what I had to do. I had to actually face that demon. Like, I had to literally face it by owning up to the secret that I had kept inside myself, with the hope that maybe the police could help me out and nobody else would have to go through that. Apparently, many people don't disclose their trauma for 25 to 30 years after the event. So I'm not alone in how that happened. It's interesting how we allow these characters who have hurt us to own us. And once I owned up to that, once I took control of that part of my life, it no longer owned me. And I was able to walk away from it. I'm not haunted by that in the slightest anymore.
Well, I'm glad. And it really seems that society's moving to a greater state of awareness around these type of things, with the Me Too movement and with what you said about people revealing their experiences 25 years later. I think people are really, society is really waking up to the depth of it. I'm just wondering, how important was it for the police to take you seriously?
I think they could have told me to go, you know, shit in my hat, or they could have told me to go away if they wanted to. But at the same time, it was nice to have that validation. Although just the activity of me actually doing it is what I feel saved me. They could have just laughed me off, but I made the effort to face my demon. And I think that's what was the important thing for me, spiritually anyway.
Now, going a little bit deeper into your story, you were adopted as a child. I know you mentioned that earlier on. Did you always know you were adopted, or was there a period of not knowing before starting life over with that knowledge?
No, I knew from the very beginning that I was adopted. As soon as my parents felt that I was able to have a conversation of any sort, they began to explain to me what adoption was and that I was adopted, that they were not my biological parents, that another mommy gave birth to me kind of thing. And they gave me books, easy to understand books and those kind of things. But there was something in me that was not able to process that in the right way. I don't know what it is. I have an addictive personality, and depression does run in my family, as I found now that I know my biological folks. So I took what they were saying and twisted it into this thing that my birth mom had thrown me out like the trash. And that is what I believed for years and years and years. And as a result, I resented her for that. And when I began to face my demons in my mid-20s, I had to face that particular thing head on. I knew that that was part of what was holding me back. I had this giant resentment toward my birth mom that I needed to relieve myself from. And so I began to work on it, like wishing her well whenever a thought of her popped into my head, those kind of things, hoping that she was having a good life. Even though I didn't mean it at times, I was taking the action to do those things. And eventually I began to believe it, and I eventually did what I think people call forgive her. Forgive her for something that I didn't really need to forgive her is what I found out later, because I met her when I was 36 years old. Had I not done that previous work, the relationship that she and I would have had when we finally met probably would have been disastrous. But today, she's my second mom, and I love her. And she protected me by putting me up for adoption, because my grandfather was a cranky alcoholic who didn't want any bastard children running around and was violent at times with my grandmother and my birth mom.
It's really wonderful to hear that you've gotten to that place.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned about forgiveness. How important was forgiveness to your starting over and freeing yourself?
What I've realized over the years, a lot of times when I have to, quote, forgive something, it is something that I have cooked up in my head. Oftentimes, a perceived hurt is not actually a hurt. It's like, oh, why didn't that person text me back? Well, maybe that person just got hit by a car. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
Maybe there's something else that's going on in their life that is really important, more important than my self-centered need to get a text back. So I will create a resentment against this person, write them off for something that is completely perceived in my own brain. So forgiveness is actually, I think it's more about rewiring that and realizing that not everybody who you think means you ill actually means you ill.
That's true. And that takes a certain awareness to do that from an objective place.
It's a lot of work.
How is the unknown of being an adopted child different than trying to keep the unknown at arm's length?
Well, growing up, I don't know, a lot of people look at their family and they know who they look like. So-and-so looks like mom, or so-and-so has grandma's eyes, that kind of stuff. I had to create all that within my own head. It was crazy. And it wasn't until I actually took the action to meet my birth mom that those voices shut up. I don't need them anymore because I know I look like her. I look like my grandmother. There's this amazing picture of my grandmother, who was a Dutch war bride, wearing this whole Dutch girl outfit, complete with the clogs and the funny white hat and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, it's my face without the mustache. I spent years being creative, coming up with who do I look like? And I think now I've got more energy because I can redirect that into something like this show that I do.
So how has that changed you as a person as compared to who you were, say, in Nova Scotia?
I was a fearful, angry person who felt that external forces were working against me. Today, I don't feel like an angry person who feels like external forces are working against me. I feel exactly the opposite. I feel like the universe is conspiring in my favor. I'm a very grateful person. I'm grateful for the friends I have. You're one of them. And I'm grateful for your friendship. You and I have had some pretty fantastic, eye-opening conversations over the years. And that's meaningful to me, to have people in my life like yourself. I know we don't meet as much as we would like, but it's meaningful for me to have people like yourself who I can trust are not going to walk away from the conversation and take what I've told them and use it against me in some way. I've never had that experience with you, you know?
No, not at all. I think it's because we connect on a certain level of what we're talking about here. The many times that you've had to start over, I've also had to start over many times. I really relate to the rhythms of that and what goes with it. I've always been fascinated by young people who have had a grounded awareness that, like you have now,
yeah,
or a connection to change from an earlier age, a deep understanding of how nothing stays the same forever. I've always been fascinated by people who really connect to that. Growing up, how prepared were you for the amount of change that life brings?
Oh, good gosh, not at all. I spent so much time in my head over the years that I wasn't prepared for any of this. I just thought life was going to be like our parents, the baby boomers, where we get out of school, we go to university, we come out of university, we get a job, and we stay at that job, have 2.2 kids and a white picket fence and a nice house, and then we die. Like, I literally thought that's what was going to happen to me. But life has taken me down some super far more interesting roads than that.
Well, how did moving to the West Coast give you a different perspective? Because I come from the East Coast, I relate to what you're saying.
Yeah.
But the West Coast actually gave me a completely different perspective. How did moving give you a different perspective? Or did it give you a different perspective?
Oh, it totally did. The best thing about it was leaving behind the life that I lived there, because I couldn't live that same life here. I just could not. It was strange. Like a change in venue for me was so important because my eyes just opened. My small town Bridgewater, it's not a big multicultural center like Vancouver. I would have never learned things about other cultures that I've learned since I moved here. Like, I am blown away by this particular city that we live in. I'm so grateful how metropolitan it is and multicultural, because here pretty much any culture goes. And there are so many to learn from, whereas I only had that weird little sort of microcosm of Bridgewater's 8,000 folks to learn from back there. Here I have millions.
Do you still remember the first day you got here on the West Coast? That early period of starting over?
Yes, and it was not pleasant. So it was raining. I was going to go to live in North Van with a buddy of mine who was living here at the time. It was pouring rain. And I remember getting off the C bus, dragging my suitcases behind me, and I walked up to a taxi driver, made eye contact with him, and when he saw my bags, he rolled up the window and drove away. That was my first experience.
Life in the big city.
With life in the big city, and I thought, oh no, what have I done? And then also talking to a girl at a bus stop here in Vancouver, I quickly began to realize she was very uncomfortable with a stranger chatting her up. And I was just, you know, having a conversation like, hey, how you doing? Kind of thing. There was no other motives other than having a conversation with another human being. But she blew me off so hard, just like, get away from me, buddy. Don't talk to me. And I was like, the hell, where am I? I felt like I was on Mars.
Did you find it difficult to scale back that openness?
I did. But at the same time, that's who I am. I'm just that kind of person, and to heck with it. If people aren't comfortable with me being me, then they're not the people I need to be around.
And did you struggle with self-identifying as an East Coaster, even though you live on the West Coast? Did you have that duality?
No, not at all. People even called me Nova Scotia Mike for a while.
Well, how have you accepted yourself as a West Coaster in a way that feels similar to your East Coast identity?
I'm married to a woman from Calgary. Carol is, she grew up in Calgary. Both of us have made our home here in Vancouver. And I just feel like we're putting down our roots here. We're doing our thing. We used to have this romantic idea about buying a house on the water somewhere in Nova Scotia and moving back there. But I look at the winters there and I think, I don't want to shovel anymore.
Well, that's the thing, right? We still have those romantic ideas as well. But then the winter kicks in and you go, ooh, I don't know about that.
One interesting thing that I want to talk about was an eye-opener for me. I went back to Nova Scotia last summer, and we had a meetup. My brother set up a meetup for the Dark Poutine folks, and there was like 15, 20 people there. And the venue that he set up the meetup at, I recognized the address when he told it to me. And I showed up to the building, and I thought, holy shit, this was the building that I lived at when I moved from Halifax to Vancouver. here I am, it was 25 years later, sitting in a coffee shop in the same building that I had left from 25 years earlier, and I had all this experience in that quarter century that all came flooding back to me at that moment, and I was so grateful. I just felt so grateful that, holy crap, what a life I've lived since I left the doors of this place. It was a mind-blowing experience.
It's good that you actually can see that as an opportunity and be grateful for it, because those experiences, sometimes people don't get those to confront the two sides of yourself.
Yeah, I used to do more regularly, do a 5 things I was grateful for every day list on Facebook, and would just say, I'm grateful for this. I'm grateful for being able to breathe. I'm grateful for having this book that I wanted, keeping it super simple. And it was that little practice of gratitude that made it a regular part of my life. Whereas before, I used to love to look for something to complain about. I love to complain. I think I was a world class, held my PhD in complaining. And today, I try not to complain as much as I did. I wish to practice more gratitude every day than complain. It's like that whole, which have I done more today? Did I complain more than I was grateful? If the answer is yes, I'd better go make some amends to people.
In this journey, Mike, what did you learn about the power of choices?
I think the biggest choice that you ever have to make is whether or not to do something. I really do. And choosing to do it, if you look at something and you can honestly say to yourself, I am not going to hurt anybody by doing this. In fact, I might improve the world a little bit by doing this. Then do it. Just do it.
After everything we've talked about, how would you describe your relationship with the process of starting over after all the moments of starting over?
Starting over, I think, is something that I'm going to have to do multiple times through my life. I mean, change is the only constant in life. So I look at every day as starting over. As soon as my eyes are open, it's like, okay, what's new? What do we got to do today? Where are we going? What is it that's going to be different? Because I don't know. I could wake up not able to use a whole side of my body some morning. I don't know, you know?
So where does hope fit into the process?
Hope is an interesting thing. I think hope can be dangerous in a way. Like hope is, I guess there's false hope, like having false hope that something is going to be successful. For me, it was like, just be real about it. Scott and I were the only 2 people to download our show on the very first night. That was it, 2 downloads, and it was Scott and I. Now, like I say, every week we have 120,000, but I never allowed myself to get too far ahead of myself to hope that we would be here because, you know, you want that, but when you hope it, there's some emotional connection to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, because with hope comes expectation sometimes.
Exactly. And expectation for me is deadly. It is deadly. It will take me to the deepest, darkest places when life does not meet my expectation. So I try not to expect anything from anybody.
My last question for you, Mike, is what's the most valuable advice for anyone who may be struggling with starting over? Because I know how hard it is for people to deal with change.
Don't do it alone. There are other people on the planet who have been through something similar to what you're going through. And there's all kinds of people out there who are willing to listen to you, to share the experience with you and share what they did to overcome it. There's always somebody out there who's been through it, always. Obviously, if you're patient zero of a particular disease, I can't say that specific thing, but there is somebody out there who has experienced being patient zero of something. So just reach out. Make friends. Connection is a super important thing for me. And like I say, that's why I'm grateful that you're my friend, Rich.
Well, I'm grateful too, Mike, that you're my friend. And thank you very much for doing this today. And everyone, you heard Mike's advice. Just reach out. If you haven't heard Dark Poutine, just reach out to Dark Poutine and you'll find Mike. It's a great show. Thanks for doing Starting Overdrive today, Mike.
And thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Starting Overdrive podcast. Join us next time for another real story of starting over. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Podbean, head to the Starting Overdrive Facebook page and hit the like button, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our channels, help us grow, and feel free to share your story of starting over. Or even let us know if you relate to any of the issues touched upon in our interviews. You can also find the Starting Overdrive podcast at www.startingoverdrive.com.